7.5, the hearsay rule. All right, I'm going to say something that you may not be happy to hear at this point, but hear me out on this. I don't really care that much about the hearsay rule. As a paralegal, there are actually very few times when I actually had to apply it. It was important to know it in general, but to actually apply it was actually fairly rare. However, the hearsay rule is a very hard rule to apply. It's actually baffling to even attorneys. I know that sounds incredible, but it's true. I read an article several years ago in the ABA Journal, the American Bar Association Journal, that actually recommended redoing the hearsay rules because the rule was so confusing, even to lawyers and even to judges. And this article actually talked about this attorney who did a study. He was an expert on the hearsay rule. He actually sat back in the back of several trials and kept track of every hearsay objection that was presented. And he came away after attending all these trials that even judges often were confused by the hearsay rule, that the ability to get an objection sustained was often more related to how vehemently the attorney was arguing it. And even if his argument really didn't make sense, the judge wouldn't want to admit it in some cases, and so just upheld the objection, and he was just astounded by that. But that should give you an idea of how difficult this rule can be. So now you're going to ask yourself, well, then why are you giving us this rule? We're just learning to be paralegals. Why would we have such a difficult rule to apply? And the answer is this. If you use the skill we're going to give you, the skill of breaking rules into elements, elementization, it means that any rule, including the hearsay rule, can be not only applied, but can in some cases, in most cases, be understood more thoroughly. But here's the really cool part of this. Even if you don't understand the hearsay rule, you can still apply it. You do not have to understand a rule to apply it. You just have to be able to apply each individual element of a rule. And we'll get into that in just a little bit. But if you get comfortable using this skill, the skill of elementization, and are able to break the hearsay rule down into its elements and then apply the rule, then it means you'll be able to apply any rule. There's no rule that will be beyond your reach if you're able to develop this skill. It's an important skill. Now, we have a demonstration on the website here right after the introduction, a demonstration to the hearsay rule. I recommend you take a look at that before proceeding. We have a lot of lecture notes here, and we talk about the rule itself and then the exceptions to the rule. Regarding the exceptions to the hearsay rule, there are two steps in the hearsay process. First, you have to determine whether it's hearsay or not. That's the first question. You don't even consider whether it's admissible at the beginning. You ask, is it hearsay? If it is hearsay, then you have to determine after that step, is it admissible? And the only way, if it is hearsay, the only way for it to be admissible is for it to fall under one of the exceptions. So first you ask yourself, is it hearsay? Then you ask yourself, if it is hearsay, is it admissible? Now, in the first question, if the answer is it's not hearsay, then it is admissible, unless some other rule such as a privilege applies. But assuming that's not the case here, regarding the hearsay rule, if it's not hearsay, it's going to be admissible. Now, hearsay itself, we cover this very thoroughly in the book, but let me just show you how important the skill of elementization is. Hearsay is in-court testimony of an out-of-court statement made by someone other than the in-court witness, offered to establish the truth of matters asserted. In establishing hearsay, the question of credibility lies with the out-of-court asserter. That sounds like gobbledygook. You're probably very worried right now that you will ever be able to understand that rule. Well, that's okay. You don't have to. Because if you break this rule into its elements, all you have to understand is each element one at a time. And by the way, there are different ways to break it down. There's no right or wrong answer when you break a rule into elements. But as long as you make it into sections that are individually easier to apply. For instance, here I'm going to break the hearsay rule down to the following elements. One, in-court testimony. Well, that's pretty easy. Is it testimony that's given in court, or is it a statement given somewhere out of court? Well, if it's in-court testimony, then we're okay so far. So far, it is hearsay. If it's out of court already, we've knocked it out. By the way, if even one of these elements doesn't apply, then it's not hearsay. So in-court testimony, let's say, yes, it is. Of an out-of-court statement, was the statement that's being asserted or being quoted, was that statement made out of court? Not the testimony from the witness on the stand now, but the statement that that witness is going to relate to the judge and jury and to the attorneys. Was that an out-of-court statement? If it was Jane standing on a corner making a statement, then yes, it's an out-of-court statement. Was that statement made by someone other than the in-court witness who's giving the testimony? So if Carl is the witness giving testimony and he says, on that street corner, I said this, well, then it's not by someone else. It's by the same person, so it's not hearsay. It's just admissible. You can always testify as to what you said if you're a witness. But if Carl is testifying as to what Jane said on the corner, then that statement was made by someone other than the in-court witness, and therefore it's still up to this stage, it's still hearsay. Offered to establish the truth of matters asserted. This is the part that trips up a lot of paralegals, and believe it or not, even lawyers. Offered to establish the truth of matters asserted. You know what this means? I have an attorney, a great attorney, who said basically, why didn't they just use the word relevant? Because is it relevant to the matter being asserted in court? And if it's relevant, if it's offered to establish whether something is relevant that's being argued in court, then it's still hearsay. If it's irrelevant to the matter being asserted in court, then it's not hearsay. In fact, it might be admissible just on the basis of relevance, but as far as hearsay goes, it's not. Now, the last element, you don't really have to worry about it. It's what we call an instructional element. In establishing hearsay, the question of credibility lies with the out-of-court asserter. In other words, if hearsay is admitted as evidence, there are two ways you can attack it. You can certainly attack the witness as to whether or not the statement was made. But in terms of the statement itself, if Jane said, I saw Peter run over somebody with his car, in terms of that statement, if you're attacking credibility, you attack the credibility of Jane, the out-of-court asserter, the person who made the statement. You have the, and it sounds like it's a limitation, but it's not. It actually expands your ability to be able to attack credibility. You can ask, was Jane wearing glasses? Did she need glasses? Did she have a good view? Did she know Peter? Did she have some gripe against Peter, some vendetta, where she's trying to say something that might not be true? You can attack that person's credibility as far as the statement itself, but you can still attack the witness's credibility, if it's appropriate, as to whether the statement made by Jane was actually made, whether Carl actually heard Jane make the statement. So hearsay is inherently weak, or it's supposed to be. The problem is that there are so many exceptions to the rule, so even after we've determined that it's hearsay, there are so many exceptions to allow the rule into evidence that most hearsay gets in. And that makes a mockery of even having a rule. Hearsay is inherently dangerous because it's somebody making a statement that somebody else is supposed to have said without really the ability to cross-examine the person who made that statement. And that's one of the fundamental aspects of our trial process. So that's why hearsay is in such need, according to many lawyers and many law school professors, it's in such need of revamping and possibly even re-education of both attorneys and paralegals and all legal aspects, including judges, all legal professions. The exceptions to the hearsay rule, there are 24 federal exceptions, believe it or not. And the very last one, I kid you not, the very last one is, and anything else the judge feels is appropriate to allow in, something like that. That's just how kind of ridiculous hearsay has gotten. But we're going to present the eight most common exceptions to the rule here. Now, we present these because we want you to have an idea of the process. But I'll be honest with you, you'll never actually have to do this as a paralegal. You will never have to figure out what exception applies. That's really a lawyer's job. But so you can have an intelligent conversation, an informed conversation with an attorney or even a judge you might know about hearsay. I think it's important for you to understand the process. Again, now let's say we've determined that a statement is in fact hearsay. That's when we move to this step. If it's not hearsay, we don't even bother with this step. But if it is hearsay, then we determine whether that hearsay is admissible. And we have those eight common exceptions. Admissions, which is somebody saying, Jane admits that she did it. That's the statement. Carl is testifying. Jane admits that she is the one who ran over Peter. That's an admission, but that's by a party to the action. Declaration against interest. It's basically an admission, but it's by a non-party to the action. So in this case, let's say that Jane isn't the one being charged. Somebody else is. And so Carl testifies, well, Jane is admitting that she is the one who ran over the person. So admission number one. The first exception is an admission by a party to the action. Declaration against interest, you can think of it as an admission by a non-party to the action, somebody who hasn't been charged. Business entries are just basically records. They can be things like accounting records or admission records at a school, things like that. But they have to have been kept as a normal part of the process. They can't be recreated just for the trial. It has to be something that was created as they would have been created on a day-to-day basis. Number four, dying declaration. You know what that is. Somebody's dying says the butler did it. Can be admitted. Now, some states actually don't allow dying declarations. Some states don't require that the person actually die. They only have to believe that they're dying. So every state kind of picks and chooses its own hearsay rules, usually loosely based on the federal rules, but they tweak them very often. So depending on the state you're in, that might or might not apply. Number five, declaration of bodily symptoms and conditions. It's basically the out-of-court witness saying, I don't feel very well, and then drops dead from poisoning or something like that. So it's a statement by the person, by the out-of-court person making a statement as to their own bodily symptoms and conditions. Declaration of state of mind is very similar to symptoms and conditions, only it's a statement of the person's knowledge and intent, that they know something was going to happen, or they know that a certain situation existed. For instance, let's say Carrie is testifying that her friend Judy and her were shopping at a store, and that Carrie testifies that Judy said, "Oh, watch out for that spilled water over there by the fruit." And then a few moments later, Judy actually slips on that same spot of water. Well, that might indicate a trial, even though it's hearsay, might indicate that Judy had a state of mind that the water existed, that the danger existed, and therefore should have avoided it. Number seven, declaration of present sense impression. This is like, you know, by the way, it's very close to state of mind. Sometimes an attorney will just throw two or three exceptions out there, hoping one of them sticks. Objection, Your Honor. It is hearsay, but it's admissible because it's a declaration of state of mind or a present sense impression. Or you can say, and a present sense impression. My impression is that there's water over there on the floor. It's very close to state of mind. And then excited utterance, also called a spontaneous declaration, usually made right after an exciting event, where Judy says, "Oh no, I just slipped on that water. Oh no, I should have avoided that water," whatever. It's after the event. That's sometimes where a spontaneous declaration gets confused, is that some people confuse it as like something that's going to happen. Well, a spontaneous declaration is typically either during an event or immediately right after an event, more typical right after an event has occurred. Now, on this website, we have several tools for you, including the commonly asked questions, which you know I'm a fan of. And at the bottom of the page, a kind of a cool exercise where you'll watch a little or read a little story and then try to determine whether hearsay applies and, in fact, whether that hearsay is admissible. You'll be able to take that as many times as you want. You might notice this one section, 7.5, we've spent a lot of time on it. It's because it is a very detailed and confusing rule. But again, what's the key to applying this rule? Breaking it down into elements, applying one element at a time, and then if all the elements of the rule apply, then that rule is applicable. If even one element doesn't apply, it's over. It's not applicable. It's not whether most of them apply, all of them. Every one of them, every element has to apply. So good luck with this, and spend some time on this, because the skill you're developing, the skill of elementization, is going to take you a long way as a paralegal.